Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 7, where we have what is one of the best known and perhaps one of the most misunderstood passages in Isaiah, the famous passage about the virgin and her son. The setting for that is in a conversation between Isaiah and the king Ahaz, who was not one of the good kings of Judah. And Ahaz was afraid. He was afraid of two things. One, as king of Judah, he was threatened by Assyria, which was basically conquering and annexing all the smaller countries in that region. And therefore, Judah was in danger of being conquered and swallowed up too by Assyria. On the other hand, there was something else more immediately to fear, and that was that the kingdom of Israel to the north and the kingdom of Syria, which were adjacent small kingdoms to the north of him, were conspiring together to start a pact to resist Assyria by their combined forces. And not thinking themselves adequate with just the two of them, they wanted Judah to get involved in this into this pact too. Well, apparently Ahaz was not confident that joining that pact would form a strong enough alliance to really resist someone as big and powerful as Assyria, and might just bring the wrath of Assyria upon them, as Assyria would hear that this group of nations, puny little nations really, was forming to resist Assyria's aggression. I think he felt like joining the pact would probably just hasten Assyria's attack on them and they'd be wiped out. So he was resisting this joining of the alliance. But the members of the alliance who had already joined, Israel and Syria, were now conspiring to come down and forcibly breach the walls of Jerusalem, take Ahaz out of office, and replace him with somebody else. That somebody else is referred to in verse 6 as the son of Tabeel, which may be an actual name, but Tabeel means a good for nothing. And so it may simply be a derisive nickname given to the man that they want to put in the place of Ahaz. He's a good for nothing. And yet he would be more compliant with the wishes of those who are trying to start this larger confederacy against Assyria. So Ahaz apparently had already determined to resist the pressure from Israel and Syria, and he was up examining the water supply of the city because he was apparently expecting a siege. And when you have a siege, you don't want to run out of food or water in the walled city, so he's apparently examining the city's water supply in anticipation that they may be besieged, and he gets news that Syria and Israel are actually deployed against him. And it's at this point that Isaiah is sent to speak with him and to urge him to not worry about those two nations, nor even about Assyria, but to worry about pleasing the Lord and to trust in God. Now, Ahaz was not of that mind. He was not one to trust God, and he was not responsive to Isaiah. And in the context of this conversation, Isaiah makes the prediction that we have come to associate with Christ due to its use in the New Testament. In verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah." Now, by the way, this is skipped over from Uzziah's death to that of the reign of Ahaz, skipped over Jotham's reign, although in verse 1 of chapter 1, we are told that the prophecy of Isaiah spanned Jotham's reign as well. Whether we have any samples of his prophesying during Jotham's reign or not, we're not ever told. But this was now Ahaz, the grandson of Uzziah, whose reign it is. This is between 735 and 720 B.C. And it happened that during that reign that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it. And it was told to the house of David, meaning Ahaz, who was the sitting king of David's dynasty, saying, "Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim." So his heart and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved. with the wind because he's frightened. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out now and meet Ahaz, you and Shear Jashub, your son, at the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. Now Shear Jashub is the first son of Isaiah. There will be another in chapter 8. Shear Jashub means a remnant shall return. And perhaps Isaiah was asked to take his son along because the name of his son is part of his message. And so he's going to meet Ahaz up by the aqueduct where the water supply is. And no doubt Ahaz is up there checking out the levels. And say to him, take heed and be quiet. Do not fear or be faint-hearted for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin in Syria and the son of Ramaliah, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Ramaliah have taken evil counsel against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabeel. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand. That is, the conspiracy against Judah will not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, that's the capital of that country, and the head of Damascus is the king there, Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken, so that it will not be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Ramaliah's son. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. That is, if he doesn't trust in God, but he trusts in some other source of security, he will be removed from office. He will not be established long term. But if he trusts in God, that will be different. Now, the 65 years would take, if this is at the beginning of Ahaz's reign, as is generally believed, 65 years from then would be the year 670 B.C. And in fact, by 670 B.C., Esarhaddon the Assyrian had come to Israel, the northern kingdom, which had already been defeated. They were defeated by an earlier Assyrian king in 722 B.C. by Sargon II. But a later Assyrian king came much later and devastated and repopulated the northern kingdom. So he brought in captives from other areas to be the population there, and he took out Israelis, and so the region was basically intermixed. There was no longer a people of Israel in the northern kingdom. They intermarried. They became what were called the Samaritans in the New Testament, and they were not a distinctive bloodline anymore. They were mixed, and so within 65 years, Ephraim was broken so that it was not a people anymore. Of course, this Ephraim was broken and defeated within like 13 years of this. But it wasn't immediate that the Israel race ceased to exist as a people. But it did within 65 years of that. Now verse 10, moreover, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. Now, apparently he's graciously saying, I realize that what I'm saying, you probably would like to see some evidence of it, and God's volunteering. He's volunteering to give you some supernatural evidence of it, if you wish. Any kind of a sign that you may ask for, God will give it to you. Just ask. Now, Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. His response was that of something like, you know, mock piety, like, I don't want to test God. But it was God who told him to do it. Now, this is a very interesting thing. When God tells you to do something and you do it, you're not testing God. If God doesn't tell you to do something and you do it, you might be testing God. As when Satan told Jesus to jump off the pinnacle of the temple because the scripture had said that God has given his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways, and in their hands they'll bear you up lest you dash your foot against a stone. So Satan said, well, the scripture promised that. Why don't you just jump? And Jesus said, you should not test. He said, it's written, you should not test the Lord your God, or not put your God to the test. What was testing God then? I mean, God made a promise that the angels were given charge, but God wasn't telling Jesus to jump off there. There are promises that God makes to his people when they're obedient to him, but you can't just do what you want to do without instruction from God, and then ask God to come through supernaturally to help you out. God's supernatural power is available to those that are obedient to Him, and His promises apply to those who obey what He says. If you are not acting in obedience to God, but you're expecting God to do miraculous things to bail you out of the stupid situation you put yourself in, that's testing God. But when God commands you to do it, you're not testing God. And Ahab was commanded by God to ask for a sign. No, I don't want to test the Lord by asking for a sign. So Isaiah is a little impatient with him. He says, "Hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will you weary my God also?" Now notice the transition from your God in verse 11 to my God in verse 13. He said, "Ahaz, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God." But it's clear that Ahaz is not being obedient to God, so Isaiah just refers to God as my God. Maybe he's not your God after all. "Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings." Now, this is a complete prophecy. The prophecy goes a slightly different direction from this point on. There is a reference to a child being born, and apparently at some not greatly advanced stage in the child's age, before he knows good from evil, before he reaches what we'd call an age of accountability, the threat to Judah will have been evaporated. The land of Syria and the land of Israel, which Ahaz was dreading, will be abandoned by both their kings. In fact, within about 3 years of this time, that was true. In 732 BC, 10 years before Samaria fell, Syria fell. Damascus and Rezin, the king there, fell to the Assyrians within 3 years of this time. If this prophecy was uttered no later than 735. Well, in 732, just 3 years later, Assyria conquered Syria. And that was the end of Rezin and Syria and their part of this threat. But there was still Israel. Israel didn't fall for another 10 years after that. So from Isaiah's conversation with Ahaz on, it was maybe 12 or 13 years till Israel fell. But he didn't say anything about Israel falling. He said the kings would be removed. And Pekah, the king of Israel, was assassinated the same year that Syria fell. So within 3 years, both kings were removed. Syria, by the defeat of his country, that is Rezin, king of Syria, was removed because his country was defeated by Assyria. And Pekah was simply assassinated by one of his countrymen. And so both kings were dead within 3 years. Now, the prophecy was there's going to be a child born, and before that child reaches the age where he knows right from wrong, these kings will be gone. Obviously, the child in question must be one that was going to be born soon thereafter. And yet we, of course, associate verse 14 with Christ, who was not born for another 700 and something years. And this confuses some people because it's very clearly quoted, that is Isaiah 7:14 is quoted by Matthew as being fulfilled in the virgin birth of Christ. In Matthew 1:23, when it speaks of Mary the virgin having a son, it says that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken in the prophet Isaiah, and it quotes this verse. "Behold, the virgin shall bring forth, shall conceive and bring forth a child, and you should call his name Emmanuel." So the verse clearly has application to Jesus, but most of the rest of the surrounding context raises questions about its application to Jesus, because it says, first of all, that this child's birth is to be a sign to King Ahaz. A sign of what? A sign that God's prophecy was true, that Syria and Israel would not conquer Judah. And God is going to give Ahaz a sign about that. A child is going to be born. And before that child reaches much of an age at all, these kings will be gone. Well, a child that was born, let's say, shortly after this utterance, would certainly fulfill that prediction. Because within 3 years of this time, those kings were gone. So it looks like it's a prophecy about something that's about to happen. And to understand this, we have to take into consideration chapter 8, although we've not yet taken all of chapter 7, but I want to show you that in chapter 8, at the beginning, it says, "Moreover, the Lord said to me, take a large scroll, write on it with a man's pen concerning Maharshalal Hashbaz. And I will take for myself faithful witnesses to record Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah. Then I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and bore a son." Obviously, Isaiah had relations with this woman. "Then the Lord said to me, call his name Maharshalal Hashbaz. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus," that's the capital of Syria, "and the spoil of Samaria," that's the capital of Israel, "will be taken away before the king of Assyria." Well, you can see this is essentially the same prediction. A child is going to be born, and before the child reaches much of an age, in chapter 7 is before he knows to choose the good and refuse the evil. In chapter 8, it's before he knows how to say mama or papa, before he can even enunciate his first words. These kings will be gone. This threat will be gone. Ahaz will not have anything to fear within a short time after the birth of this child. That's the prediction, and it's predicted about Isaiah's child, Maharshalal Hashbaz, which, by the way, is a name that means speed the spoil, hasten the booty. Now, there was a prophecy given after that in chapter 8, apparently spoken to the child at its birth. You might think that's strange. Why would you speak to a child that can't even understand? It's just a manner of doing things. Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist, did the same thing. When John the Baptist was born, he uttered a prophecy and directed it to the child, too. The child couldn't understand it. It's more for effect. Isaiah then seems to give a prophecy to his child. And the child is told that Assyria is going to come into the land. And in verse 8, speaking of Assyria, this is chapter 8, verse 8, Isaiah says, "He will pass through Judah, he will overthrow and pass over, he will reach up to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel." Now he's speaking to his child, apparently, and he calls his child Emmanuel. So we have some interesting things to sort out here. Isaiah, in chapter 7, predicted to Ahaz a child is going to be born. In the very early stages of that child's life, these two kings are going to cease to be a threat, and the child will be called Emmanuel. Now, Emmanuel means God with us, or alternately, God is with us. The Hebrew form can allow either translation, God is with us, or God with us. Obviously, to say when this child is born, his name will be called God with us, or God is with us, means that the birth of this child is the sign that God is still with Judah. And so Isaiah's son is born in the next chapter, and the same things are said about him. Now, there's a couple of problems, though. One is that we're told in the New Testament that Isaiah 7:14 is about Jesus. Yet, if you did not have the New Testament to tell you that, any thinking person reading chapter 7 and then reading verse 8, chapter 8 would say, oh, okay, prediction in chapter 7, fulfillment in chapter 8, Isaiah's son. And the parallels are, you know, that there'll be a woman who'd conceive and bear a son. His name will be called Emmanuel. And in his infancy, these two kings will be removed. Both things true of both sons. But there's a couple of things that kind of stick in the throat here, for the Christian anyway. Maybe not for the original Jewish readers, but for the Christian who has come to associate this with Jesus and the virgin birth, we got two problems. One is, it says in verse 14 of chapter 7, the virgin will conceive and bring forth a child. Isaiah's child was not born of a virgin, certainly. It specifically says he went into her and she conceived, which obviously means that they had sexual relations. Now, commentators say this was Isaiah's wife. Well, probably was. If she had not been before, she probably became his wife before this conception took place. He might have gone and married this woman Of course, he already had a wife, or had had one, because he had a son already named Shir-Jashub. Though we know nothing about Shir-Jashub's mother. Maybe she had died. You know, maybe Isaiah was a single man, and he may have married a new woman, and this was their first child. There's certainly no suggestion of anything immoral going on here, but it is clear that Isaiah went to this prophetess. It's interesting, he doesn't say, go to your wife, but rather it may be God instructing him to marry this prophetess and have a child with her, who a woman who was not yet married. And yet she certainly was not a virgin when the conception took place, because Isaiah and she had normal relations, and Mahershalel Hashbaz was born, conceived and born in the natural means. So on this, some people have argued various ways. Some have said that virgin here, the word alma in the Hebrew, doesn't mean a woman who's pristine and sexually inexperienced so much as it just means a young woman of marriageable age. Very common for commentators to bring this up. That alma doesn't necessarily mean what we mean when we use the word virgin. In the Hebrew, it doesn't have the quite the same narrow range of meaning. It just means any woman who's of marriageable age. She may be sexually pure or not, but if she's not married and has never been married, she's called an alma. So it is argued. This would suggest then that Isaiah's wife could be the virgin in question, the alma. She was, of course, not a virgin when she conceived, but she was a young woman of marriageable age. In favor of this view, scholars who put it forward say there's another word for virgin in the Hebrew language. It's betula, or betula. But betula, they say, means a virgin, a woman with no sexual history. Whereas alma is more generic for a young woman of marriageable age. And they say that this passage uses the word alma, not betula, so it's not specifically indicating what we call a virgin. And therefore, Isaiah's wife could qualify here. Now, by the way, another objection that Christians sometimes would raise to this suggestion is that this child's birth is supposed to be a sign. The Lord will give you a sign, Ahaz. And therefore, you know, how could it be a sign if a baby is born in a natural way? You know, we almost want a sign to be a supernatural event. However, that objection falls to the ground because a sign doesn't have to be a supernatural event. It just has to be a predicted event, an event that is predicted and then takes place. It doesn't have to be supernatural. And if you look later in chapter 8 of Isaiah, verse 18, Isaiah is speaking. He says, here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me. That would be Shir-Jashub and Mahershalel Hashbaz. He says, we are for signs and wonders in Israel. Who? Isaiah and his children are signs. So there's certainly no objection to saying that Mahershalel Hashbaz's birth was a sign. Isaiah himself says so. And so it doesn't have to be a supernatural sign. So in other words, if we didn't have the New Testament identifying this with Jesus, many scholars say, we would not be looking for a literal virgin birth, a miraculous virgin birth. It doesn't have to be miraculous to be a sign, and the alma doesn't have to be a virgin. And therefore, everything about the passage works out fine for it to be Isaiah's wife in question. Now, an important thing that is often missed in this discussion is that it does not say a virgin will conceive. It says the virgin will conceive. What does the phrase the virgin mean? There is a specific person or entity that is called the virgin rather than a generic a virgin will conceive. Who would Israel, who would Ahaz have taken to be the virgin? Well, the answer to that may be found in Isaiah chapter 37. Isaiah 37 and verse 22, where Hezekiah is encouraged by Israel to send a message to the besieging Assyrian king Sennacherib with this message. This is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning him. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, has despised you, laughed you to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem has shaken her head behind her back. Your back, excuse me. Don't shake your head behind your own back. So In other words, you are being mocked, Sennacherib, by this little girl, Jerusalem. Now, little girl, virgin, would suggest, of course, the most unimpressive, the most unintimidating sort of person, a child, female child. Here's Sennacherib, the big tough guy in the block, and he's threatening the city, and the city's like a little child, a little girl compared to him. But she's mocking him on purpose because God is going to protect her. And yet notice how he calls her. He calls her the virgin. So Isaiah earlier said the virgin will conceive and bring forth a son. But here the virgin refers to Jerusalem or the population of Jerusalem. A child is going to be born in Jerusalem. In Revelation chapter 12, the opening verses, we see the remnant of Israel represented as a woman pregnant to bear a son, and her son is to rule the nations with a rod of iron. This is, of course, the birth of Jesus. He's said to be born from this woman, but the woman is really not a real woman. She represents Israel. Jesus was a product of the Jewish race. The Jewish people produced Jesus, as it were, biologically. It's not speaking of his specific mother Mary, but rather personifying the nation or the remnant of the nation that produced Jesus as a woman pregnant. So in Isaiah's day, he could speak of his own child, who was born in Jerusalem, was a child of Jerusalem. The virgin Jerusalem produced a child. And that child's significance was that his birth spelled the near end of Syria and Israel. And so the virgin here could refer to Jerusalem rather than to Isaiah's wife or to any woman in particular. One objection that could be raised to this is that in Isaiah 7:14, virgin is the word alma, whereas in chapter 37, verse 22, the cross-reference I gave you, the virgin is the betula. Different words, but words that have a similar range of meaning. When Isaiah was translated into Greek in the Septuagint, virgin in both passages was translated with the same word, parthenos. Parthenos is the Greek word for a literal virgin. And the Septuagint translators translated virgin in both places with the same Greek word, parthenos. Though in the Hebrew is alma in one place and betula in the other, the Greek scholars apparently took those words as essentially equivalent, synonyms. They could use the same Greek word to translate them both. And so it is that even though a different Hebrew word is used, the imagery of a virgin as the virgin, not a virgin, the virgin, which Judah is called or Jerusalem is called in chapter 37, could be the virgin referred to in Isaiah 7:14 as well. In any case, all objections to Isaiah's child being the child prophesied seem to be easy to deal with. Even if we wish to take the virgin, Isaiah 7:14, as a literal virgin in the English sense of the word, the sense of our English word virgin, a woman who had never had sex, it's possible that when Isaiah spoke these words, his future wife, the prophetess, was in fact a virgin. But then he married her and she conceived and had a son. If, say, the virgin will conceive, could be saying a woman who is at this moment a virgin and therefore is clearly not yet pregnant will at some point in the future, not necessarily while remaining to be a virgin, but she's the virgin who is now a virgin, will conceive and bear a son, meaning this will happen to a woman who isn't even on the way to having a son yet. She's a virgin at the moment, but she will soon conceive and will have a son, and the birth of that son will be such and such. I don't think it is a reference to Isaiah's wife, though. I think it's a reference to Jerusalem as the virgin. In any case, there is no reason why a Jew without the New Testament, while reading this, would have to apply it to the Messiah or would have to apply it to anyone other than the son that is born in Isaiah chapter 8. However, remember, with reference to the apostles of Christ, when he rose from the dead and met with them in the upper room, he opened their understanding so that they might understand the scriptures. That is, they saw in the scriptures things that others didn't see, things the Jews would not see, things the rabbis didn't know. If the scriptures contain no meanings other than those that the rabbis already knew, there's no reason for Jesus to have to open their understanding to understand them, because they could listen to the rabbis anytime they wanted to. They could get the meaning from them. But clearly, there were meanings in the Old Testament that the rabbis had not and could not apprehend. This apparently being one of them, because Matthew, of course, quotes Isaiah 7:14 as fulfilled in the virgin birth of Christ. Now, in doing so, in all likelihood, Matthew is doing so the same way he saw, "Out of Egypt I've called my son," as having a fulfillment in the youth of Christ. "Out of Egypt I've called my son," in Hosea 11:1, is a statement about Israel. But the apostles saw Israel as a type of Christ. And so what was true of Israel was also true of Christ. It is very probable that Matthew also, by inspiration, having his eyes open, his understanding open so he'd understand the scriptures properly, he saw that Mahershala El Hashbaz likewise was a type of Christ. And how significant indeed it was that the wording of the passage about Mahershala Hashbaz's birth mentioned a virgin, although it might have meant it in a very different way than Matthew meant it. Nonetheless, just like son was meant differently in Hosea 11:1 than the way Matthew used it in Matthew chapter 2, the words had different meanings, but the statement as it stands is a statement of the same of this new fact. The new fact is there's a real virgin. Not just a symbol for Jerusalem being called a virgin, but there's an actual virgin woman who conceives and has a son, and his name is called Emmanuel. Certainly, God with us is a proper nickname for Jesus. And in its own way, apparently a proper nickname for Isaiah's son, too. He was the indicator that God was with Judah. But how much more, when Jesus is born, is that an indicator that God is with us? In other words, there's type and antitype going on here, probably. And I imagine that's how Matthew understood it. And if we say, well, it sounds like a stretch, maybe it is a stretch for us if we were speculating. Matthew's not speculating. He's inspired by the Holy Spirit. And therefore, we see that though there may indeed have been a fulfillment, and maybe the only fulfillment that the Jews ever expected in Isaiah's own son, yet they didn't expect enough. They didn't know what to expect. The Holy Spirit sees something else in this, a secondary fulfillment. This is one of the few times in the Bible that we actually have identified for us secondary fulfillments of prophecy, where there's actually a fulfillment recorded in the Old Testament and then another fulfillment recorded in the New. There's more than one of these, but not many more. It's pretty unusual. But I think that that's what we're looking at here. And that would explain why, after it talks about the birth of the child, in Isaiah 7:15, it says, "Curds and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land which you dread will be forsaken by her kings." Now, a couple of things, questions arise. First of all, why is the child called Emmanuel? Jesus was never called that. His name shall be called Emmanuel. If that's referring to Jesus, well, that's not what he was called. He was called Jesus, not Emmanuel. But, of course, we have to realize that to the Hebrew, the expression "his name shall be called" is simply a way of saying his identity shall actually be. It's not talking about what he'll actually be called by people, but really who he really is. Just as two chapters later in Isaiah says his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. That's also his name shall be called, but he was never called any of those things. It means that's who he really is. He is God with us. He is Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God. In Jeremiah, it says his name shall be called Jehovah Tzidkenu, which means the Lord our righteousness, speaking of Christ. His name shall be called that. I think it's Jeremiah 23:5-6. So lots of things Jesus' name is said to be is not really what his proper name was. It's not the name on his birth certificate. It's actually a reference to who he actually is. When you see that man, who you are seeing is God with us. When you see that man, who you're seeing is the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father. You're seeing Jehovah, our righteousness, and so forth. And so it is the Hebrew wording should not be mistaken to be a prediction that Jesus' actual proper name will be Emmanuel or any of these other names that are given to him in the Old Testament. But what's this curds and honey business? Why is God going to be eating curds and honey? Well, as we see, as we'll go through the remainder of this chapter, that because of the devastation coming on the land, there will be little to sustain the population. The remnant that are there will have to live on curds, which is, you know, a dairy product that they could get from if they happen to nurture a young cow. I mean, have a little bit of livestock left. And honey is something you could, you know, harvest from nature. I mean, the bees do that. You go get the honey from them in nature. In other words, stuff that you can get without farming. There's not much food to be had. If you happen to have a goat or a cow, you can make some curds, get a little protein. If you need carbs, you go out and find some honey in a honeycomb somewhere. But that's how people will survive for a while, because there won't be really agricultural produce because of the, perhaps because of the siege. But in any case, we see, for example, in verse 21, it shall be in a day, in that day, that a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep. So it will be from the abundance of the milk they give that he will eat curds. For curds and honey shall everyone eat who is left in the land. So to say the child will eat curds and honey just means he'll be living during the same period where everybody's eating curds and honey. The child is going to be suffering the same deprivation as the nation in general, but not for very long, because the threat will disappear when Syria and Israel disappear. That is, the immediate threat will. Now, in verse 17, it says, the Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. And the Assyrian coming upon them is very possibly threatened against the northern kingdom. Although Ahaz is in this picture, and he's the king of the southern kingdom, the oracle could still be addressed against Israel. And I think it probably is. And that being so, I think what Isaiah is saying is that the Assyrians are going to come against you, Israel, to the north. Just like when he speaks to Babylon or others that aren't really present to listen, even when he prophesies to a child who can't understand him. It's just a way of expression, that you speak to somebody that you know, things that are pertinent to them, whether they can hear you or not. It goes on record, and then we learn what he had to say to them. But the Lord will bring Assyria, the king of Assyria, against you. I think it's starting a new section here. Verse 16, I think, ends the prophecy that directly applies to Ahaz. But now, because he's brought up the fact that the two kings of Israel and Syria will be removed, he addresses them and says, as if he says, O Syria, O Israel, the king of Assyria is going to be brought against you. That's what I think is happening here. And it says, these are things that are going to come against you that are worse than anything that's happened since Israel separated from Judah in the days of Rehoboam, the worst calamity Israel's had. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the farthest part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. And they will come, and all of them will rest in desolate valleys, in the clefts of the rocks, and on all the thorns and all the pastures. The same day the Lord will shave with a hired razor, with those from beyond the river, with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the legs, and will also remove the beard. Again, Israel being compared to a man with hair, and it's being shaved. It's really, he's just mowing down the population, just like you mow down the hairs on your face when you shave it. The people are being mowed down like hairs on a body. It shall be in that day that a man shall keep alive a young cow and two sheep, so it'll be from the abundance of the milk that they give that he will eat curds. For curds and honey will everyone eat who is left in the land. It shall happen in that day that whoever there could be, wherever there could be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it will be for briars and thorns. With arrows and bows, men will come there, because all the land will become briars and thorns. And to any hill which could be dug with a hoe, you will not go there for fear of briars and thorns. And it will become a range for oxen and a place for sheep to roam. Now, it's not evident why people would avoid hoeing a mound for fear of briars and thorns. Unless it's saying the thorns and briars be so thick that you simply can't remove them without getting torn up yourself. But it's possible that briars and thorns here is referring to evil enemies, as seems to be the case in some other passages. It's not clear here. But he may be saying because the wicked, the briars and the thorns, are inhabiting the area, you won't be able to make use of the area. It's hard to understand some of this imagery, how it's intended in terms of fulfillment. Then we read already chapter 8, verses 1 through 4, which was about him going into the prophetess and having this child. And verse 5 of chapter 8 says, "The Lord also spoke to me again, saying, inasmuch as these people refuse the waters of Shiloah that flow softly and rejoice in reason and Ramaliah's son, now therefore, behold, the Lord brings up over them the waters of the river." Meaning the river, like that, always means Euphrates. Whenever it just says the river in the Bible, it means the Euphrates. It says they're refusing water from this pool of the spring of Shiloah. This was actually the only freshwater spring inside the walls of Jerusalem. And so it was a water supply in the city that could hold up in times of siege. But it was obviously the water that God supplied for them, supplied for the city. And it's symbolic of just God's provision. You refuse God's provision. You refuse God's solutions. The waters of Shiloh that flow gently. Things could go well for you. God would deal gently with you. But instead, you rejoice in someone else. And so the waters of the Euphrates, meaning Assyria, is going to come up. And that won't be gentle. It'll be like a flood. It says, the waters of the river, verse 7, strong and mighty, the king of Assyria in all his glory, he will go up over all his channels and go over all his banks. As he's flooding outside the banks of the river, meaning he's flooding into other people's land. And he will pass through Judah and will overflow and pass over. He will reach up to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Now, I believe that verses 6 and 7 are about Israel, the northern kingdom. They're the ones who rejoice in reason, the son of Remaliah's son. That is, they're in confederacy with him. And also with the reason and Ramaliah's son, that is the two kings of Israel and Assyria, the northern kingdom is rejoicing in them, and they are the ones who are going to be overrun. But it says in verse 7 that overflowing river that runs through Assyria and wipes it out will also flow into Judah and will cover that land except for the head, that is, except for Jerusalem. Judah is like an animal or a person who's in a flood and only the head is above water. The water has reached up to the neck and into Emmanuel's land, into the land of Isaiah's son. "Be shattered, O you peoples, be broken in pieces. Give ear, all you from far countries. Gird yourself and be broken in pieces. Gird yourself and be broken in pieces." Didn't you hear me the first time? Gird yourself and be broken in pieces. "Take counsel together, but it will come to nothing. Speak the word, but it will not stand, for God is with us," which is another occurrence of Emmanuel in the passage. Now, this is obviously addressed to Syria and Israel. This prophecy is not against Judah, although Judah is mentioned as also experiencing the overflow of that flood of Assyria. But this is really about the destruction of those kings that are threatening Judah here. And he says, go ahead, make your plans. Take counsel together. It's not going to come to anything. You're not going to overcome this city because God is in this city. God's with us. And that's an amazing thing in view of the fact that the city was so far from God. But it was not God's will at that time to destroy it. There was apparently a larger remnant of faithful people in Judah than there was in Israel. And Israel's time had come. Judah's was not yet. So God was going to preserve them at this time. Verse 11, "For the Lord spoke thus to me with a strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying," now this is what God said to him, "do not say a conspiracy concerning all that this people call a conspiracy, nor be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. But Yahweh of hosts, him you shall hallow, him you shall fear. Let him be your fear, in other words, and let him be your dread. He will be as a sanctuary, same word that's used for tabernacle elsewhere, but it means a safe place in this instance. But a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, and as a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble. They shall fall and be broken, be snared and be taken. Now, obviously there's some material here in these verses that is quoted in the New Testament. This business about be not afraid of their threats or be troubled, but let the Lord be your sanctuary, or sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, is brought up by Peter in 1 Peter 3:15. He quotes from this passage about not being troubled or not being fearful, and he's doing it in the context of not being afraid of persecution as Christians. When it says, do not say a conspiracy, in other words, don't cast your eyes on what man is planning to do, no matter how powerful they are, no matter how many of them join together. Those who join arm in arm against the Lord will not succeed, and therefore, if there is a conspiracy, it's not a problem to you. You just trust in God. And obviously that's a relevant message to people who are concerned about conspiracies today, because there are conspiracies. But you're not supposed to be focusing on that. You can't do anything about them anyway. Just let the Lord be your sanctuary. Let him be your fear and who you dread. Now, when it says he, in verse 14, will be a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, I'm sure you recognize that as a verse that's quoted from time to time in the New Testament, not just once. And it is applied to Jesus. So he, who in verse 13 is Yahweh, is Jesus. I mean, the way the New Testament quotes verse 14 repeatedly, it's always applied to Jesus. And that being so, Peter quotes it in 1 Peter 2:8. Paul quotes it in Romans 9:33. That Jesus is the stumbling stone. But here it's Yahweh. And the fact that the Christian writers would quote this about Jesus without apology means that they take it for granted that what is said about Yahweh in Isaiah is really about Jesus. He is Yahweh. And what he's saying is that God will do things in a way that the Jews as a whole would not probably appreciate, and they may stumble at it. When John the Baptist was not quite impressed with the way Jesus was doing things and sent messengers, say, are you the one who's to come or not? Jesus sent messengers back to John, said, well, tell him what you see. You know, the blind see, the lame are walking, the deaf hear, and the gospel is being preached to the poor. He says, and tell John this, blessed is he who's not stumbled by me. In other words, I'm not doing things the way you want me to. You could be stumbled. Don't be. Trust me. I know what I'm doing. Blessed is he who's not stumbled by me means trust me. But if you don't trust me, you're going to be confused by what I'm doing. It may stumble you. It may make you fall. You may lose faith. That's the way God sometimes is, and the way God's working in Isaiah, in Israel and Judah here. He says it'll stumble some people. Many will stumble, it says in verse 15, and shall fall and be broken. Now, verse 16 says, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait on Yahweh who hides his face from the house of Jacob. I will hope in him. Here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me. We are for signs and wonders in Israel, whom the Lord of hosts, from the Lord of hosts who dwells in Mount Zion. Now bind up the testimony, seal it, the law among my disciples, apparently means take these things that Isaiah has written, wrap them up, put a seal on them, bind them up, and commit them to the custody of faithful men, the remnant in Israel who were following Isaiah. And they would preserve it, and apparently they did. It's not likely that Isaiah alone preserved his writings. He handed them over to his disciples, and they preserved them. Isaiah himself was later killed, probably by Manasseh, but his disciples apparently preserved his words so that we have them today. And you bind them up and seal them, basically, because in all likelihood they would date them too, so that it was obvious since they were bound up that no one added to them. And when you break the seal and see what's in there at a later date and see that what was written was fulfilled, the fact that it was bound up all that time in between shows that it was not written recently or added to. it becomes a testimony to the veracity of the prophet that his words were sealed up on a certain date, and when they were opened, lo and behold, they'd been fulfilled in an interim. Now, when he says, "Here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me," apparently he's saying this to God. He says, "I'm going to go wait on the Lord. I'm going to go look for God. I'm going to present myself to God. Here I am, God, and my children too. We're the signs and wonders that you've given to Israel. We're waiting on you." Now, this statement, "Here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me," is actually quoted in Hebrews 2:13 as if it is Jesus speaking. The writer of Hebrews is pointing out that Jesus, though he was, of course, God and you know, greater than all of us, yet he was not ashamed to humble himself to be called our brethren and his children. And he quotes some Old Testament verses to make the point. It's in Hebrews, actually chapter 2, verse 11, says, "Both he who sanctifies," meaning Jesus, "and those who are sanctified," meaning us, "are all of one." That is, we're all of one nature, all human beings. Jesus humbled himself to become one of us. "For which reason he's not ashamed to call them brethren," which is an amazing thing, that he who is our creator would actually reduce himself to speak about us as equals, almost, as brethren. And he quotes from Psalm 22:22, "I will declare your name among my brethren." So there Jesus, although it's David speaking in Psalm 22, it's attributed to Jesus calling us his brethren. But then down in verse 13, he goes off and quotes a few more verses, Isaiah 8:17 and 8:18. "I will put my trust in him," is Isaiah 8:17. And then again, "Here am I and the children whom God has given me," which is the next verse. He quotes two verses where Isaiah speaks about himself and his children and applies it as if Jesus is the one speaking. The idea being that Jesus calls us his brethren and he calls us his children. In other words, he deigns to include us as close relatives, even though he is God and we're not. But the point here is that apparently Isaiah himself is now being seen as a type of Christ, as David is. The writer of Hebrews quotes David in Psalm 22 and says that's Jesus speaking. He quotes Isaiah and says that's Jesus speaking too, which means that there are many persons in the Old Testament that are treated as types of Christ, so that what they say about themselves is seen as applicable to what Jesus would also say and applicable to him. Well, we're about done this hour, but let's look at the last few verses of Isaiah chapter 8. Verse 19 says, "And when they say to you, 'Seek those who are mediums and wizards, who whisper and mutter,'" which is apparently what people were doing instead of turning to God in Jerusalem. They want to know what things were happening, so they go talk to a fortune teller or a medium to contact the dead and get information from them. He says, "Should they seek the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them." Now, the mediums don't talk according to the same way that Isaiah talked. Isaiah gave the word of the Lord. And if they don't speak in agreement with what he said, well, then they're just wrong. They're just in the dark. There's no light in them, he says. "And they will pass through it," and this "they will pass through it" apparently is going back, all the way back to verse 10, which was talking about Assyria's aggression. And it seems to be talking about Assyria here. "They will pass through it," that is Judah, "hard-pressed and hungry. And it shall happen when they are hungry that they will be enraged and curse their king and their God and look upward. Then they will look to the earth and see trouble and darkness, gloom and anguish, and they shall be driven into darkness." Now they here, I believe, is a reference back to Assyria. Obviously, it could be harking back to Israel or someone else. It's hard to say. It's not at all clear who they are in verse 21 because there was no antecedent in the previous 10 verses. And so, unless it was the disciples of Isaiah, which doesn't seem likely. So I said Assyria, it could be Israel, it doesn't really much matter. The point is that all the parties, all the bad guys, Israel who will be destroyed by Assyria, and Assyria who themselves will come under judgment from God, can be described almost in the same way. Eventually, they're going to be driven into darkness themselves. Well, we have to stop there. And we'll have to come back to that next time.